Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. We do politics here, but if your guys are not tired of politics this season, we kind of are. So we have Bill Timmerman in today.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk about something I really like today.
So instead of talking about politics and Trump's latest weird action, we're going to be talking about cooking with our favorite chef from Flagstaff. You want to introduce her, Bill?
Yeah, this is Nancy McCullough. Hi, Nancy. Hello. Who is the owner of a catering service called Simply Delicious and one of my favorite restaurants of all time, Cafe Daily Fare.
Well, thank you.
And welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Cafe Daily Fare is kind of a find. I mean, you have to drive through two car lots to get to your restaurant. You said it's in an old ice house.
Yeah, it was built in 1948.
For a long time, only people from Flagstaff seemed to know about it, know about Nancy's restaurant. And the treasurer of Democratic Perspective and I were having lunch the other day, and we were sitting outside. It's very dog-friendly. You got a big bowl of water for the woofers, and you can sit outside. And suddenly there were people there from Colorado and from California and Florida in the restaurant. So, all right, I normally don't talk to people that I don't know at a restaurant. But I said, how did you find out about this place? And the answer is TripAdvisor and Yelp.
Yes.
And what are some of the other services. And you're getting just really, really good reviews. Bill saw the one negative review he saw was, what was the guy? The guy didn't like onions.
Well, yeah, he said, it was in the back of a car lot. We had to park six blocks away, and when we got there, there was too many onions and too much garlic and everything.
And too many people.
And too many people. And so I says to myself, I think I know who you are. Next time, try Denny's.
Yeah, I think he's the wrong guy to go to your restaurant.
Or just let us know that you don't like onions.
Yeah. How did you get, I guess the question I wanted to start with was, the big question I wanted to ask that I told Nancy before the show is, how did you get to so that you cook so well? You're a really good cook.
Thank you.
But how did you start?
Well,
and why is everything you do different from what everybody else does?
I don't know what everybody else does, but I started young. I mean, I started when I was about 13 years old. And, you know, after years of doing it, I've been in a kitchen. I'm in my 50s now, so that's a long time. If I hadn't gotten good by now, I probably shouldn't have gone into this business. But I don't know. I think it sort of chooses you, you know, and you've got to like it. You've got to love it and be curious. And you also have to have a really good memory. So if you did something 10 years ago and it comes up again, you got to try to remember how you got there.
How did you get working in a German bakery when you were 13?
Well, you know, I really wanted to do it, and I had to have my mother sign a permission slip for the state of Illinois to allow me to go do that. And so I would get up at around 4 o'clock in the morning and walk down to the bakery. And then right before school started, I would walk to school, because we walked in those days, you know, through the snow in Chicago area. But, you know, I still remember like the little flower footprints as I was leaving the bakery, and they mm-hmm. fade away as I got closer to school. So,
well, at least it wasn't coal mining.
Right. It was flour, white lung, actually.
Yeah. I suppose that's an occupational hazard.
Why did you have that happen?
Why did you want to start cooking? I mean, working in a bakery when you were just 13, you'd been interested in food much before you were 13, right?
In retrospect, yes. You know, definitely always an emotional attachment to food. I think most of us have. But I recall when I was like 4 or 5, like breaking down into tears when I tore the peanut butter sandwich bread. So, and then I would make, my mom had to work. So somebody had to get dinner in the stove. So, you know, it would usually be call my mom and then get the chicken in the oven or do whatever I needed to do to get dinner started.
And working those hours in the bakery, that didn't turn you off to cooking. That got you more
interested. Well, you know, we were working on old school equipment, so I was working on like crazy machinery, like dipping the eclairs in these big monstrosities. And, you know, there was very little OSHA safety rules in those days. So we had a lot of fun.
So for a 13-year-old, you get to handle big, dangerous machinery.
Yes, making, and frost
making really
cakes.
Weird, crazy things.
Yes, and frosting huge cakes and watching these old German guys, you know, throwing dough around. I mean, it was fun. You know, I had never done anything like that, so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, it must have been fun for them, too, to have somebody who's actually interested in what they were doing.
You know, I don't even know if I knew if I was interested then. It was just a lot of fun to just go in there, and because you got to do everything. It's not like you were tasked and had to stay in one spot, you know, making pedophores one day and eclairs the next and donuts, and you could eat as many as you wanted.
Wow.
Well, how did you move from there to the top of the stove? Like, you know, when I was younger, I worked in restaurants, some of them big, fancy places, and, you know, mostly mopping floors, running the dishwasher, but...
I'm still doing that, too.
But it seems to me that, you know, in my experience, there were bakers, and then there were cooks, mm-hmm. and, you know, rarely did you find somebody who was willing to do both, let alone competent to do both. So how did you move from baking to the top of the stove, or did you really move?
No, I don't know if I've ever moved. I mean, we still do all that from scratch, and for years in Flagstaff, I was known as the cake lady. So I've made
she
a lot of wedding
cakes. Absolutely
beautiful,
spectacular cakes. Oh, there are some really original designs on your wedding cakes. They're the ones I've seen. I've only seen them on the internet, but they're gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Some of those are my taste, and some of those are my bride's and groom's taste. But I've had to back off over the years, because after 35 years of doing cakes, your shoulders and your wrists aren't what they used to be. Right, so you modify, right. You accommodate for that kind of thing.
For those of you who haven't worked in a restaurant, in a kitchen, it's a pretty rough life. I mean, it's hard work, and it's physical mm-hmm. work, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And I guess... When I was a younger and worked in as a bartender in New York, I worked in a fancy French restaurant on Fifth Avenue. And one day the New York Times came to interview the chef.
They asked him
about the dessert, some dessert that was really spectacular. And he's gone on to fame and fortune, but he had no idea. He had no idea how the dessert was made. He had to call the pastry chef out to talk to the paper. Because I was watching. It was really funny. It was French, and he just rolled his eyes. He had no idea whatsoever. But you do both, and always have done both. Then.
I started from the end of the meal and worked my way to the center of the plate. And I think a lot of people focus mostly on that center of the plate, the entree, or, you know, a.k.a. meat, which doesn't. You know, and now in our culture, that's not necessarily the center of the plate anymore. So I feel pretty lucky to have worked my way toward the center as opposed from the center to the way out.
Yeah, I remember years ago, I was an Army brat, so we did a lot of traveling around, mm-hmm. driving in cars, and I can remember endless two-lane highways with roadside restaurants. And, you know, it was Howard Johnson's was the big chain restaurant in those days. There were no McDonald's, but there were all these chicken in the basket places and mom and pop roadside restaurants. And the thing I remember is it was all pretty much fried. And if you got a vegetable at all, it was going to be overboiled peas or green beans or something. You never saw a salad. And if you did, it almost never saw a salad. And if you did, it was, you know, your iceberg lettuce with a mixture of mayonnaise and ketchup on it.
Yes.
That was sort of the way to
French.
So you must have grown up in that environment, too, with fast food and
lima
junk
beans
food.
In a bag, remember those?
Yeah. And yet, Nancy is one of the best chefs I know. And
it's true.
Your cooking is really spectacular and extremely modest. I mean, you're able to turn out really highly crafted stuff that that people pay large amounts of money for when it's presented a little fancier, but that's the thing. So if you, Nancy's restaurant, let's tell us again where it is, and then I like to know how you got started. You got started in catering in Flagstaff.
Yes. So I've been, first of all, we're in the eastern end of the downtown footprint of downtown Flagstaff. And about 17 years ago, my husband and I, Duffy, we were like, okay, we've got to figure out if we're going to just get on this bus or not get on this bus. Because I had been leasing kitchens, so I had been catering for a while. And that's even, I used to do freelance baking too, which is a whole other long story.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we were looking for a place to land. And I had a couple stipulations, having spent more than half of my life in white-walled rooms with fluorescent lights and no windows. It's like, if I'm going to have this, I'm going to be living here. And I need a window.
Yeah.
I need a window. And ideally, I wanted a tree, too. But I got the trees next to me, so I'm pretty lucky there.
Your customers get the tree.
Yeah, the customers get the tree. But I get to go out and see them, so that's all
right. I guess in the kitchens, I in the places I worked, I don't think I ever saw a window in
there
the kitchen.
That's why we're all so pasty looking, because we never get to see the light of day.
It's also hot.
Yes, it is very hot.
It is really hot in the kitchen, folks.
Yeah, they're not kidding when they say if you can't take the heat.
So you're in Flagstaff. Yeah, I mean, it is. People don't understand it because it's now there's cooking channels and there's this and that all over, and it's now a kind of cult of cooking or a real interest in cooking. But they don't understand that the effort that has to go in and the discipline. And it can be imposed a lot of different ways. And I, in restaurants I've worked with, we have chefs who were absolute megalomaniac disciplinarians. And we've had the other guys who, let's break out the beer guys. And so there's a lot of variation. So you're in Flagstaff and you have to decide whether you're going to stay in Flagstaff or not and what you're going to do there. And you decide to found a formal catering business and then a restaurant.
Well, I think life makes the decisions for you. You know, I have my first son, he's 27, and I don't want to move around. I mean, I had worked under Albert Hall at Forest Highlands. He's an excellent, excellent mentor chef. And he's like, Nance, you could go down, take one class at the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, and go do a short apprenticeship, and you could make really good money as a pastry chef. You know, even though I was already working, doing a lot other than pastry. But I've got my son. I'm in a really cool town. It's a great place to have kids. And who really wants to move to Phoenix?
Amen.
Yes. So, you know, and then things evolve. You know, you're working in restaurants. I started up one of the bakeries in town. That didn't pan out. But I had always been catering on the side. I mean, I used to raffle off dinners to put myself through college because we had a kitchen in the basement. And so I was always doing a little bit of catering on the side. The first real big dog I ever did was up at Shoshone Point at the Canyon, 250 people, and I went after kebabs. What was I thinking?
Oh, yeah. My Lord.
Yeah, I don't know what. I wasn't, apparently. But I had to bring a babysitter along, so bring my son up there, too, because he was still nursing. So, yeah, I've had that going on. So Flagstaff is just the place to be, you know, and it's been 30 years now, give or take. I'm an NAU alumni. But what do you do when you're in college? You work in restaurants to put yourself through college.
You work in bars.
And, yes.
You know. So go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say, you know, we were talking about how original your food is and how well prepared it is. And the fact that you don't really do tall food.
Well put.
Which, you know, has its attractions. I'm sure Thomas Keller, you know, is a fine chef, and I'd enjoy eating his food. But the thing about it is that we've gotten, everybody's a foodie now. We've gotten to think of food as some sort of performance art. But it really isn't. I mean, in one sense, it's not about the show. It's about how it tastes.
I would agree. And if you're going to be, like we were just talking about, a smaller town, and if you're going to be feeding people every day, hopefully, if they want to come back,
yeah.
you're not going to be doing the same five things all the time. So you can have your sandwiches and your Brazilian fish stew and cool stuff like duck tacos, which that was a struggle to get on the menu.
Duck tacos, I haven't had. Bill, Nancy has these incredible blackberry duck tacos. Bill has them and loves them. I love your fish tacos. I never saw a fish taco like you do fish tacos.
Thanks. I played with those for a long time.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Because everything Nancy does, folks, is different from what you might expect. And so when you go to a restaurant and you order fish tacos, you're not going to get the kind of fish tacos that you're used to getting in a lot of other places. You're going to get something you're going to get something really interesting.
Yeah. We use snapper.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite.
Oh, thank you.
Fishes. But the duck tacos, people, if I could sing, you'd be in a lot of trouble. Those are incredible. Absolutely.
Well, I had to figure out a way to get duck on a lunch menu because I love duck.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love to eat cute animals. They're all kind of cute. But, you know, I had seared duck breast and I couldn't even give it away. Something you'd spend $40 for in a tall restaurant, like you said.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even give it away. But what will people do? They'll eat a taco.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how that snuck on my menu.
First time I went to Nancy's restaurant, it was a local place that I had never heard of, and I'd been going to Flagstaff for years, and somebody recommended it. We went up there, and I got there, and there were things on the menu like Brazilian fish stew. It sounded really interesting. We used to eat a lot of Brazilian food in New York, and what was the other one? Oh, it had lamb stew.
Lamb stew.
I said, what kind of a restaurant actually has lamb stew? And that's what I ordered.
I mean,
the first dish I ordered in your restaurant.
And you came back.
Was the last.
You survived.
Yeah, I came back. I thought, this person has incredible guts to be able to put lamb stew on the menu because this is like, I don't know. This is like middle America here. Yeah. People don't.
Well, we're also right next to the churro lambs, though. I wish I could get my hands on it, but. You know, before we were a cafe, the space that is the cafe was a banquet facility. And so we would hold a lot of events there, or we would be hired to hold an event. And one of them was the Churro Lamb Council. And so these guys brought me all this lamb to play with, like the best lamb you've ever had.
Mm.
And so, you know, I probably messed around with that lamb and did it like 6 or 8 different ways. And the lamb stew just kept coming up and coming up. And so when we opened the cafe, it's like, well, I should do some lamb. Look where we live. The reservation's on all three sides of us. And I thought I'd stop making it in the summer months, but I would have mutiny.
Yes, you would. And I'd be right at the front waving a pitchfork.
We're doing like 15 gallons a week of that stuff. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, you use different spices and stuff in your lamb stew.
A little curry.
You don't do the southwestern kind of spicy lamb stew. Mm-hmm. It has a different flavor.
Or the Middle Eastern version.
Well, it does have a little curry going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a pretty simple stew. It's all about the lamb.
Yeah. Boy.
As opposed to like a bourguignon or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's what always gets me about the television chefs, you know. They do bœuf bourguignon in 30 minutes. Well,
that's impossible.
I got to tell you, ain't nobody does bœuf bourguignon in 30 minutes.
That's, no, it's an all
day. I don't care
how
big a name chef you are.
So Nancy's restaurant is in an old ice house. How did you find the ice house, and how did you decide to put a catering business and then a restaurant in an ice house behind a car lot?
Three reasons. Cheap rent, loaded with power, and it had a sewer line.
Mm.
So, you know, cheap rent is massive in Flagstaff because we have a very small downtown footprint. Mm. So it's hard to find a building there that actually has parking.
Right.
So
right.
Folks might complain about that, but I actually do have
parking.
When you do
get the parking, it's the best parking space you will ever get because it is under the trees and it's right next to the restaurant.
So my husband converted the whole thing. It was trashed. It was like burned out trucks, you know, scree pile. I mean, 2 years later, I was still picking up stuff off the ground, broken glass and car parts. And so it was a pretty trashed out space. But it was built in 1948, and it was originally an ice house that supplied Camp Navajo,
mm-hmm.
Where they were demolishing all the munitions there.
Yeah.
So, and then they built onto, they added onto the building. So the original structure, the 48, is a Malapai stone. Mm-hmm. Then they built onto the structure, and it was a foundry for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So hence all the metal embedded in the floor and all that.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I thought, there should be a railroad running.
There right. used to be.
Because it looks exactly like warehouses that were next to a railroad. Yeah.
Yes, because the railroad used to go right down there to Babbitt's, downtown Flagstaff, and transport all that stuff.
So I wasn't wrong.
Huh? No, you weren't. You were right on the money.
No, when you look at the floor, you can see that it was really an industrial space.
That's why we didn't cover it. You know, why would you hide that?
Yeah, right. it's wonderful. And what you did with the lighting, this little light bulbs that run
along—they're kind of Dr. Seussy, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're so cool. I could try to figure out where the electrical connection ran into those lights because they seemed to go all the way around the room, and I couldn't find
them. It's
see
up
a wire.
In the loft. So there was, you know, like literally there weren't even any walls in there. There was nothing. So my husband dropped it all down, put all the bones in, drywall the whole thing. And, you know, all the power's in the ceiling in that building because it's all stone around the peripheral. So all my real estate's up high. Basically, uh-huh. Very tall ceilings. Same thing in the kitchen. My water heater is suspended 8 feet in the air.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, that gives you more room underneath.
That's well, exactly.
Swing your knives
yes.
and stuff. Yeah.
So you started out catering there, or you started out with the catering and a sort of takeout business, or how did this go? It's now a real restaurant, folks. Mm-hmm. It's very pretty inside. It's very nice. There's some nice table to sit outside. But how did it evolve?
So we used to have, like I said, the cafe space used to be our banquet facility. And about 2006 is when I looked around and the country clubs were going to open up their venues to outside folks. Like you didn't have to be a member there to go have a big party or a wedding or a celebration. So I looked around and Flagstaff, we just talked about, has very few venues, including large facilities, to have your event. So I'm like, okay, there go all my big gigs. Catering, because we didn't have the cafe at the time. So and about the same time I was working for a client, we were doing, after a 3-week-long training period, we did their graduation celebration, fancy schmancy, simply delicious stuff. And I asked my contact, I said, Tanya, who's been feeding them the rest of these weeks, and what's the price point?
Yeah.
So we started, that's when we created Daily Fare, which was the drop-off delivery service. We wanted to call it something other than Simply Delicious because you don't want the sandwich lady in charge of your wedding that you're serving marinated quail, right?
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that's when that started, and we kind of tested menus out and did questionnaires for about 6 months, and we started making sandwiches, which we used to joke about that.
And you make very, very good sandwiches, I think Bill has a favorite there, don't you? But what I think is interesting is the sandwiches are never quite what you expect. They're just better than that.
Yeah, they're way better. Well, one of the things that I was surprised about when I first went in there is you had that big case over against
the deli case. Yeah. We missed the deli case.
And it was full of all kinds of wonderful things, and you could go and stare at it, and you could point to it, and you could actually get some.
Yes.
It's so much more fun than a menu. I don't know, was that a holdover from the catering? Or?
Well, that's because when we did the Daily Fare, when that first started, we thought we were going to be a grab-and-go place. Now, see, this was right when the economy tanked, right? So we, you know, okay, zero bells and whistles catering is what Daily Fare is. It's all about good food, but here's your lunch, have a wonderful time, see you later. Yeah. So we opened the cafe, quote-unquote, thinking we were going to be a grab-and-go place, hence on the back of the T-shirts, good food for the taking.
Yes.
And I loved my deli case. I loved to feed that beast is what we started to call it. You know, it was a big case.
Because you have to have stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, there's nothing like a place that has a deli case, but there's not much in the deli case. Well, it makes you very worried if you're a customer. And her deli case was filled with all kinds of interesting, different
things. We had it packed.
Things.
It was a lot of fun.
Oh, God, I love looking at a deli case. It was kind of like the real version of those Japanese places where they have plastic replicas of their
food
in
their
window.
That's a whole art form, though.
Oh, I know. But the problem is you put it in the window and the sun fades it. And then it doesn't look so appetizing.
That's true.
So you got to keep replacing it. But inside this Oh, you
the
could.
Deli case is gone now. It looks more like a real little restaurant. It's,
we needed
you've got
to.
A lot of customers.
Mm-hmm. We needed to. You know, you can make the best food on the planet, but if somebody can't get in and out on their lunch break, that's a terrible reputation.
Yeah.
So people were having to wait. And, you know, you can rely on tourists all you want, but my feeling is that we live in our towns and we need to be feeding our own people.
Yeah.
So I've got to make sure that someone who's got their lunch break can get their lunch, not feel rushed. So we had to double the seating, which was really nice.
Yeah,
fast, slow food.
That's right. Yes, we try. Yeah.
So, well, I wanted to ask about the business end, right? Because we've already talked about what hard work and long hours are involved in restaurants. I mean, it's physical labor, folks. It's mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's like being a hod carrier sometimes, and not only that, it has to be done with a great deal of precision. If you're going to put really good food out,
consistency.
Yes, consistency, and you have to control almost every element. You have to control temperature. You have to control textures. You have to control plate arrangements, and you know supplies. You don't just slop the sauce on with a ladle and send it out. You know, but. In addition to all of the physical labor and the skill that it takes to produce good food, there's also the whole business end. You know, there's the logistics, right? This is something I've always wanted to ask about because I look at what goes out of a of the kitchen in a restaurant, and I try to imagine what it looked like when it came in and how it got there and all the rest of it. And when I worked in large kitchens, it just baffled me how the chef and the cooks dealt with all the stuff that was coming in and figured out the menus. So I'd really sort of like to ask about, you know, how do you predict demand? How do you decide on the recipes and the ingredients and the sourcing for those ingredients? And how do you deal with pricing and margins and, you know, all of that sort of the grunt work that goes behind the artistry?
Well, that's a big question. As far as sourcing goes, you know, you have to really keep track of that. You're constantly comparing your order guides. Although this time of the year when the farmers markets are exploding and going nuts, you sort of say, wait a minute, I only get to work with really cool produce.
Yeah.
About 6 months out of the year, maybe 8 or 9. So as far as deciding on the menu, tied to that is we're processing hundreds of pounds of food right now because it's all in season.
Right.
You know, why even bother with a tomato down the line?
And you've got wastage to consider, too. Right?
Yes, you know, you make stocks out of a lot of what you've got left over on your produce. And, you know, then we also compost with Roots Composting. So they come and pick up our composting. The sourcing. So, yes, you're constantly looking at that because food cost is huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's, you know, hopefully you're going to be in the 20% zone. Sometimes you're going to go higher. Some items on your menu are not really going to pay for themselves, but something, you know, rob Peter, pay Paul.
Yeah.
You know, so, because if you wanted to make everything profitable, then I would just make pizza.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
You know, but that's not what I'm in.
Yeah,
for.
I wonder about that because, you know, some of the stuff I've eaten in your place are. I thought, how in the world can she put out a plate like this for this price and still make a nickel on it? You know, because I know what I know what the raw materials cost at least retail. I don't know about wholesale, but
wholesale sometimes you're paying for the convenience. So when you're buying from one of the larger purveyors, you are paying for the convenience of it.
A lot of times it's not that much cheaper
when
they're ordering wholesale. You'd be surprised, folks. They're not getting a huge discount normally.
No. You know, and hence why we end up shopping at the grocery store sometimes, too, because, like, well, peppers are how much here and peppers are how much there. We'll go for the
cheaper. So let me ask you a specific question, and the business is doing well, I take it.
Yes, sir.
You're getting,
keep knocking,
you know,
on wood.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier. I mean, there's more and more tourists there. People are hearing about your restaurant.
Social media is huge.
Social media is just bringing there. So, when I first started going to Nancy's restaurant, there were really only locals there, occasional tourists, or at least that's what it looked like to me.
No, you're,
I don't,
you're
know,
correct.
Because I don't talk to people. And now they're happy tourists, you know, every time you go there.
And they're giving you the stars, too.
Yeah. And you get to, what I think is nice is you get to stay in your wonderful space and have your wonderful restaurant, and you have people find it a lot more now. And so it's not just locals. It's people traveling, get to eat in your restaurant rather than, you know, I don't know what.
I think it's when you really, like that old saying, like if you just stand in one place, like the world will come to your doorway.
You cook as good as you do, the world comes to your door. If you cook as good as I do, the world never shows up.
That's right.
So let me ask you about, and Bill can get back to the business of it, because I think the business that you're in is, and I think folks would really be interested in the details, I mean, of restaurant business. But I want to ask another question, because I'm kind of discursive here. Take something like Brazilian fish stew. Let's take one dish. If you want to take that one, or how did that evolve to be on your menu? Because you have a regular menu, and then you have new items all the time.
Specials
all the time.
Yes,
that's how we got that wonderful trout almond.
Right. Yeah. Right. And same thing with the bouillabaisse that we were talking about earlier. You know. So, or beef bourguignon. Yeah. School real deal. So how did something come on? Brazilian's actually a really good example because a long time ago, before the internet, if anyone even remembers, you'd go to the library.
Back when there were books?
Yes. There still are. Flagstaff Public Library is still a great library.
I've been known to Xerox a menu out of a cookbook from the library.
Sure, sure. So I used to pull down four or five books and cross-reference the same recipe. And obviously, nothing is ever done exactly the same. Right. You know, yes, there's Julia Child's version of beef bourguignon, you know, but how many people do a little twist on it?
Yeah.
So when I was looking up Brazilian fish stew, fast forward to the days of the internet, I did the same thing and cross-referenced several Brazilian fish stews. I think I just got turned onto it from looking for something else, which is usually the way that happens, you know.
It's extremely... One thing I respect about your cooking is the clarity of it and also the intensity. You're not, the Brazilian fish stew is very intense and you're not afraid of that kind
of
intensity.
If you're going to say it,
you're not dumbing down your food. You're not dumbing down your food. When you get a Brazilian fish stew, it is an experience. I mean, it's intense. It's,
thank you.
I guess most of us, Bill and I, we go in so many restaurants where everything is, you know, the chef, the cook, the owner, who are trying to make a business, tries to keep taking it down a notch. I was in a restaurant, and they had tried serving their dishes with drumsticks, chicken drumsticks.
Mm-hmm.
And people hated it. And so they switched to chicken breast, which was dry. You know, even with the sauce and unpenetrated by the sauce. And they just did that because people didn't understand that, you know, that was a good chicken. Drumsticks were a good part of the chicken. Yeah. So what I don't see you,
thigh's my favorite. I'm a thigh girl.
Yeah. I mean,
me too.
Yeah. You have to think about these. So you cross-reference the studies. You look at a bunch of different recipes, and then you decide which one you like, and then you play with it, and then you decide, you have to go through the process. Will people order this if I put it on my menu? Because Brazilian stew is not something you see, I don't know, Northern Arizona, anywhere
else. You run them as a special. You know, that's the way you can do it. I mean, first of all, we're testing and tasting in the kitchen. So yes, it all starts with cross-referencing those things and making some notes. And as I mentioned earlier, you've got to have a good memory to be a cook. You've got to have a good memory. That's all I really hire people for. Is are you nice and do you have a good memory? Because I got to hang out with you every day.
Yeah. Well.
So the Brazilian, that was like, I don't really even consider whether or not it will sell. I think I'm just wanting to play with something. And specials, you know, when you're running it that way, I'll come up to you and say, hey, Bill, what do you think about this? And I've got my one table of ladies when I had a little love affair with pozoles about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I missed that. Oh.
I'm still doing them.
I've had the chicken pozoles. Very different. I make pozole all the time, and it's completely different than what I do. It's like a different universe.
But I have this one table of ladies, and they're my pozole tasters. But so I'll ask my customers, how do you like this? How do you like this?
Oh, yeah.
And so you test things out, and your child almondine is not like any child almondine I ever had.
Thank you.
How did you come up with something that's familiar, but also very good.
Sometimes I don't know how to answer those questions.
Yeah.
You're just in there and you go for it. I mean, one of the, for instance on that is my spinach enchiladas have apricots in them.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know. People ask me that and I don't know. I mean, when you think about Spanish cooking, there's a lot of dried fruits, et cetera, being used there up against the meats.
Arab cooking also.
Yes, yes. So I don't know. It seems like you start to think regionally. About the way you approach food. For me, it's like an equatorial band around the planet.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that when I talked to you years ago.
Right. It still makes sense to me.
And what do you mean by that, Nancy?
It seems like, you know, if you're in Mexico or South America, I should say, to be more correct about that, and Asia, you know, there's like this, or the Mediterranean, all those foods, they have something in common, which there's a lot of vegetables, there's a lot of produce, there's a lot of straight-ahead meats, not a lot of starches, that kind of a thing. So, for instance, we do a wok char salmon with a serrano cilantro vinaigrette. So the wok char is Asian, and then serrano cilantro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it seems that you just mess around that way. And I think, again, the memory thing. If you've been cooking as long as I have, hopefully I've got a memory.
Yeah, you've got a repertoire of flavors in it.
Yes, yes.
And so you're actually playing and experimenting with the food. And the restaurant's very consistent. I mean,
you
go there
That's
on any
huge.
Day, and the food stays the same. There's always something new on the menu. So the impression I got when I first went to your restaurant is there's somebody who's really, and somebody got mad at me for things. I said, no. The chef really thinks about food, you know? They're a thinker. And I meant that it wasn't rote. You weren't just pulling things out of some recipe. You just weren't repeating what you had tried.
How boring would that be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I'm going to do this and I'm doing it and you live it, you've got to keep it interesting.
Well, one of my examples is, we ordered the special, the trout almondine, the day you had it on special. And Steve and I, were there for lunch, and we got the last two. And so it came out, and it's absolutely beautiful. There's potatoes, you know, there's
rosemary and lemon.
Yeah, and a lovely salad. But the trout is orange.
Yeah.
It's orange. It's steelhead trout, right, which is trout. But
ruby red, ruby, yeah. Yeah.
But it's unlike any... It's unlike any trout almondine I've ever had before, and it is absolutely incredibly good.
Oh, thank you. You'll have to come back next year, because right now I'm messing around with walleye. But it's just went out of season.
Yeah,
so.
Well,
we had the guy next to us on the next table wanted it, and you had sold out of it for the day. But the guy sitting there took one look at it and said, you know, I'd like to order that.
Oh, that's hot Italian. Once you make one... Once we get the first order for that in, we make two right away because that one sells.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, you know, you said you have to have a good memory. And I think not only for ingredients and combinations, you know, I mean, and like the French say, once you learn to make the four basic sauces, you can make anything. If you can make mayonnaise, you can make hollandaise, you can make béarnaise, you know, blah, 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 blah. I think that holds for... all cooking, you know.
And baking.
Yeah, well, baking I know nothing about, but I know a little bit about cooking. But the thing that strikes me is what the memories are not only about the ingredients and the combinations of ingredients, but also about the techniques, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the most important things about good food is the control of textures, okay? And this is something that's almost entirely technique, right? I mean,
I think that just like any other skill, you've got to learn the basics before you break the rules. So I have a ceramics degree from NAU, and there's a very famous potter. His name is Peter Volkos, and he was the first guy to violate the lip, basically. So he'd make a Grecian urn, and then he'd tear it apart. And he's like the first guy that did this back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, but boy, did he know his technique. He knew how to get the clay right, throw it, fire it, whatever he needed to do. So, in other words, you got to learn it before you mess around with it. Because then it's like, again, it's like putty in your hands, to be a bad cliche.
So, how do you train your... So, you're doing most stuff from memory. You don't have a big list of...
I actually do. My life's work is right there. So, no, I write it down. You have to write it down because that would just be chaos. Mm.
And how about your staff? How do you you seem to have – it's very good – somebody who worked in kitchens and as a bartender, like I did, going in and out and talking to people and, mm-hmm. and stuff. The other thing that I was it's a good vibe place. You have a good vibe kitchen. Some
Thanks.
Kitchens you can feel the tension.
Oh, yes.
You can feel the tension
I've
there.
Worked in those kitchens.
Yes.
And I didn't want to have that kind of kitchen because if I'm going to live there – and I'm going to spend more time with some of these kids are young now.
They all look young.
Yeah, I know.
They
all look young. Yeah, so if I'm going to spend, you know, more time with these folks than I do with my family, I'll hire somebody on personality. Personality, and if they can talk as fast as I can.
Well, boy, I tell you, you got a great staff. I love them. You know,
thanks. It's the best crew I've ever worked with.
Yeah. So. They really pay attention, and they don't mess with your head. And
they're respectful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And interested. And they're genuine. I mean, these folks are genuine.
Were you training any of them to be chefs?
You know, in my kitchen, you know, part of the vibe that you were picking up on is, you know, I've worked in those hierarchical kitchens. The one with the person with the biggest hat is the person in charge and usually has the ego to match. Yeah. But in my place, we cross-train. So I don't really have, like, a solid front of the house, back mm-hmm. of the house, because that is like a war zone. I've worked in those kitchens.
Yeah. Always blame the waiter.
Oh, and vice versa. You know, when my husband and I, again, started to do this, I had to really, really do some self-examination and say, okay, am I going to turn into that guy?
Right.
Because that scared me more than anything. I can fall on my face, but I just didn't want to be that.
So sometimes, folks, when you're in a kitchen, it's totally hierarchical. It's totally disciplined, especially in a fancy restaurant.
Militaristic.
It is sort of militaristic. I mean, there's the chef, the sous chef. Wow. Well, the time has just really gone by. And give us the name of your restaurant. Give us the address. And I don't know how to say this, but I mean, we love your restaurant.
Oh, thank you very much.
I think both Bill and I have this deep respect for somebody who's a real craftsperson and who's really trying to do the right thing. There's so much mediocre stuff out there. Mm-hmm.
You guys will let me know if I drop the ball, okay?
Yeah. And in Democratic perspective, we do.
Not going to happen.
We haven't supported the local arts, but we do want to support businesses, original businesses, and good businesses. We want to enrich the Verde Valley, and that's why we have shows on wine industry and Old Town and we have a couple of announcements, Bill,
and you didn't
give us your address.
Yeah, better.
I'm getting older.
Downtown Flagstaff, we are Simply Delicious Full Service Catering and Cafe Daily Fare, and I'm in a tucked in place, but you'll find us. And we're only hard to find the first time.
That is true. It's fun to drive up there. The parking is good, and the food is very good.
Yeah.
I'm going to pass this to Bill.
Go eat.
Thank you.
Manja.
Bill cooks hamburgers at the door picnic.
Yeah.
And also hot dogs and veggie burgers.
Democrats of the Red Rocks, one of our wonderful sponsors, is having its annual picnic in the park, Sunday, September 18th, 2016. And
it's $5 for lunch. It's a bargain.
And it's going to be at the Posse Ground Park
here in Sedona. It's moved from its old location. And then right before that, on September 15th, Thursday, they're going to have a breakfast. And they're going to have Michael Weiser, and the title of it is Progressive in a Conservative Land. And they're going to have people from, I don't know much about it, Regulation and Taxation of Marijuana Act. Someone talking about that. That's at 8 a.m. at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill. And I believe it's like $12 a fee for it. Really, you get the kind of breakfast you don't normally eat. And the speakers, and you learn a whole lot about politics. About out of time. All right, this is a Democratic Perspective. And we're talking today with Nancy McCullough, Simply Delicious and Cafe Daily Fare. And thank you for being with us. Next week, we have an exciting, stimulating show.
probably about politics, which won't be nearly as nice as this.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.